Welcome to the Information Security Forum videocast. I'm your host, Tavia Gilbert, and today we're bringing you a conversation with journalist Nick Witchell and ISF Managing Director Steve Durbin. In this wide-ranging conversation, Steve will share his insights on the role of cyber in society and its impact on individuals and the future outlook.
Steve, let's begin with the threat horizon, because that's what preoccupies so many people. Little reason for cheer, many reasons for concern. Is the risk not in danger of running out of control?
I think that would be a fair comment, Nick, because there is undoubtedly this feeling of it all becoming a bit overwhelming. How can I possibly cope with it? But if we go back to one of the principles around the threat horizon is there to try to identify upcoming threats so that we are forewarned, forearmed, can do something about it. And what the ISF has always done with that threat horizon is try to pull out issues, yes, at the basic security level, but also then say, what does this actually mean from a business standpoint, and what does a business and organization need to do in order to avoid some of those threats, mitigate some of those risks?
I want to come back to that in a lot more detail in a moment, but you say forewarned is forearmed.
Yeah.
Part of the problem, surely, is that although we are forewarned, we are not forearming ourselves, and that is one of the major issues that we confront, isn't it?
It is. I think there is, for too long, we've struggled from a security standpoint, I think, to be taken seriously. And so, again, what we have to do is to really demonstrate that threats relate to risk, that relate to the sorts of things that businesses need to deal with. Our ability, from a business leader standpoint, to grow market share, to protect our assets, to deliver shareholder value, to deliver value back to our employees, to provide an environment for them to succeed. And certainly in the latest threat horizon, which we call a physical and digital worlds collide, then we're highlighting the fact this is becoming very much more difficult to do, yes, but actually is just so all-pervasive across society that we have no option but to do something about it.
All-pervasive across society, as you say. What are the particular threats that give you most cause for concern? Is it the state-sponsored stuff or the criminal, malicious, or a combination of all of it, I suppose?
It is a bit of a combination of all of it. I think the ones that concern me most are the ones that we perhaps have the least ability to influence at the moment, either because we haven't spent the time, the resources dealing with them, or because they are just so new, so fresh.
And what are those?
Well, one of the ones that immediately comes to mind that I am concerned about is the Internet of Things, or, as we call it in another report, the Internet of Forgotten Things. So for a number of years now, we have been putting Internet of Things devices out into our corporate and home real estate without really thinking about the security implications of that. When I talk about security today, I talk about security by design, about building in security from the beginning. Well, we have a number of devices out there that were created with no thought whatsoever to security, that have no ability to be upgraded, to be made secure, and in some instances exist we know not where. So that is the real issue for me, because it opens up a door to the attacker. If we don't know where it is, we can't control it. If we can't control it, how do we manage it? And that's one of the big issues.
And that, of course, begs the question as to the identity, the source of these attacks. Now, a lot of attention in Europe and in North America to what's happening in China. There is a lot of suspicion, particularly, of course, in the United States. How suspicious should we be? How cautious should we be in dealing with some very large Chinese corporations? I'm not particularly going to mention any names, but I think we have one particular name in mind. Mm-hmm. How suspicious should we be?
I think we always have to be cautious, irrespective of where the manufacturer is coming from. I think what is important is that we do our due diligence, that we are comfortable that we can control, manage, monitor whatever devices we're putting into our infrastructure, whether that be a statewide network, or whether it be within our own homes, for instance. we have to go through the process of assessing risk. To your point about the Chinese in particular, I think one of the issues with that that has caused concern is that Chinese government has introduced legislation that does require this sharing of information. And that clearly presents some challenges.
And are you confident that our, by that I mean the West's, resilience is more than a match for the other guy's inventiveness and aggression?
I think to that, we have to rely on people in the know. So we have to take advice. We have to consult with security services, as we've done in the UK, for instance. We have to look at regulation. Should we be putting some form of regulatory envelope around all of this to help protect us? We need to be looking at it from a governmental standpoint. And I'm careful in my choice of words here, because I'm talking about governmental with responsibility, not political for the sake of expediency. So from a governmental standpoint, we need to be assessing that. And we need to be soliciting views from business and pulling that all together. So it's about collaboration to arrive at the right decision rather than anything else.
You talked about political expediency. Interesting use of the word there. Do you worry that cyber is becoming something of a political football?
I think it has. And I think that is a reflection of the maturing of the industry, but also of the importance going forward. If we look at, we often talk about the fourth industrial revolution, which is going to be digitally based. Well, if we think about that for a moment, that is all about getting a better understanding of technology, but of the use of that technology so that you can use it to create new market opportunities, more employment, secure your environment, all of those sorts of things. So cyber, for me, has become something of a political football, yes.
And I think you're saying that in a funny kind of a way, we should be encouraged by that because it means that politicians are taking much more notice and paying much more attention to the whole issue of cyber and the challenges that it throws up.
Absolutely right. For years, I suppose I've waited for this day, if you like, when cyber eventually arrives and is viewed as being a serious issue, because I think for too long it has been viewed as being something that is tucked away, something that perhaps is within the remit of information technology. And that really doesn't give you a head start in trying to deal with some of these much, much bigger challenges that we face.
Before we leave the whole question of the threat horizon, I understand that climate change features in the threat horizon for the first time. Why?
Yeah, for the very first time, I think it has its own home. We've seen certainly over the last 12 months, big discussions around global warming. We've seen outbreaks of fire, for instance, in Australia that has devastated the landscape. Certainly, if we look at the way that climate change is going to continue over the coming years and within the threat horizon, that's just a two-year horizon, remember, then we are concerned that it will impact business continuity, disaster recovery, location of infrastructure, critical infrastructure, smart cities, because as the oceans rise, that creates a problem on the land. If we then look at where these systems are based and how dependent we are upon them, that's what's giving cause to concern.
Lots of issues there, which I sense you may feel that business is not sufficiently aware of at the moment. Just before we come to that, let's just turn to geopolitics, if you like. Are you assured that at the international regulatory legislative level, sufficient attention, sufficient real action is being taken on this issue?
I think we've seen some very real advances. I think that with the General Data Protection Regulation across Europe, that is now, 14 months old, 12 months old, something like that, that had a very real impact. That for me was a turning point in regulation. It really caused people to sit up and pay attention. We have the California Consumer Protection Act that's recently come in California. We have the debate around, well, should there be a federal system of privacy across the United States as opposed to state-based? So we've got a number of different conversations going on all around the world, which we didn't have before, around how do we regulate, how do we protect data which is being shared at speeds that we've never seen, which will be shared even faster when we move into a 5G environment.
Lots of conversations. Now, if I were a cynic, I would say, well, that's part of the problem. People just talk about this, but nothing concrete tends to emerge. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that the speed of technological change is something that challenges regulators, challenges governments, and challenges businesses. The consumer loves it because we're always getting our new device. It's always fresh. It's always something different. Regulators hate it because they have to try to put in place some form of legislation that is going to last for more than the next generation of equipment that comes down the line. So what we're seeing is a change in the way in which regulators, are behaving. Government is even further behind that because government operates at a much slower pace, of course. But I think that if we can get legislation and regulators to move much more quickly to be able to catch up, to perhaps not to abandon, but to move to a position that says, we're not going to get it right first time. We are going to have to adapt. We are going to have to change. I remember when GDPR was being talked about, talking to some of the European MPs that were part of that working group. And their question to me all the time was, have we got it right? Are we future-proofing this? And the answer is no. But you have to accept that you will never get it right and you will never future-proof it. So build in the controls and the ability to adapt and change in real time, as opposed to taking what can be a somewhat arduous process to...
Just before we come to the all-important business responses, your mention of GDPR, of course, reminds us that within our continent of Europe, there has been a rather significant change. Does the UK's departure from the European Union, does that cause you any particular concerns in the cyber context?
In the cyber context, not so much. I think that obviously for the next... For this year, throughout this year, we're still tied to GDPR from a UK standpoint. I think that there is sufficient time to put in place some of the alternatives in terms of some of that information sharing. I think that the UK has always formed a very key part in terms of the security services through Five Eyes, through working with Europol, Interpol, and so on. I think that the UK is very well respected in that regard. And so I'm not one of these advocates of the whole thing being, thrown out simply because we've left. I think the value to everybody in collaboration is too strong for that. But clearly, we're going to have to rethink some of the ways in which we deal with data, some of the ways in which we share data. And that really is where some of the work needs to begin.
Cyber is a business issue. I think you've already said that or intimated that several times. But is it the case that that truism, that fact, is penetrating into boards and senior executives to the level, to the degree that it needs to?
I think we've got better. We haven't finally arrived at the destination, but we know we need to get better at it. And I say that because I see in the work that I do with boards, in some of the lecturing that I do down at Henley as well with boards, I see that there is a much greater readiness to ask the questions about, well, what are the implications of that? What should I be looking at? One of the challenges for boards, and I found this myself, is that all too often, when we talk about cyber, we talk about security, we're talking about it in a language that we don't understand. It's being created for us by IT specialists or security specialists, and the translation hasn't taken place. And that, for me, is a really important piece to bear in mind. You know, the board can only decide and make decisions when it understands intimately what's going on. And so the security guys need to do a better job of that translation. The board needs to do a better job of asking for that translation, and we all need to do a better job of working together to get the outcome that's needed so we can make the right decisions.
Yeah, I can understand how somebody who's from a financial or a general business background won't understand the intricacies of cyber. What I struggle to understand is how somebody who's risen to a very senior position in a large company doesn't understand that this could be a real threat which could massively harm the bottom line. What is it that they're not understanding?
I think that the challenge, Nick, is that for too long we have viewed cyber through, as I say, this very technical lens. One of the challenges that we've always lived with in security is, and for the board, this is exceptionally difficult for them to understand, is how do we demonstrate a return on investment? Because there is no such thing as 100% security. So in pretty much every other line of business, you can look for a return on investment and you will get it. Security has never been very good at doing that. It's never really seen the need for it. It's looked at it more from a process standpoint, from a standards, from a policies, from a maturity perspective. And increasingly what we're starting to see is business leaders saying, okay, if this really is an issue that I need to be focused on, give me some form of return on investment, quantify the cyber risk. That's having a very significant change.
So are you saying that there is a greater onus on the cyber specialists to put the business case in a more effective fashion than there is on the senior executives to open their minds more to this?
I think we both have to we both have responsibility. But certainly I think if we look at CISOs of the future, or chief security officers of the future, because we're seeing a bringing together as well, which is interesting, I think, of both the physical security and the digital security, then a lot of those people now are very much more business people than technical. The traditional security person perhaps wasn't. But we are starting to see them coming in from other parts of the business. That makes life a lot easier because they can articulate it.
And is it getting easier as the generations change, as younger people occupy senior positions who are perhaps less nervous of this whole subject? Do you see an encouragement there?
I do. And I think that one of the challenges that we're going to have to work through is this management of multi-generational workforce. Because there are different perspectives, there are different expectancies, if you like, in terms of the role that I have or that you have in terms of delivering security. And for me, and I've said this very often, for me, security is a people issue. It isn't just a technology issue. You can't put a technology wrapper around it because people are touching it all the time. And so we have the potential as people to be the strongest link in the security chain. It's a cliche, but it's true. How you then manage across all of these different generations when there are different expectations requires a very high degree of emotional intelligence from the chief security officer. It requires the ability to work collaboratively with teams right the way across the business. And, of course, to be able to articulate that at the most senior of levels.
I mean, these are fundamental principles of leadership that
they
you're
are.
Talking about,
yeah,
really. Leadership through change. Now, you've encountered a great deal of that in your own career. How have you approached it?
I think you have to start from the position that you don't know the answer. So you are taking a step into the unknown. And a lot of people don't like that. But particularly from a security standpoint, you really don't like that. So I can sympathise. From my perspective, I think my approach has always been to try to learn as much as possible from people who have been there before. A lot of it of my time has been taken up by listening to what other people are doing across the different departments and really trying to understand how that fits with where the organization has an aspiration to be from a strategic standpoint. So you're combining all of these things from future business direction through to where we are today and really trying to close that gap in as collaborative a way as possible because it's about the management of transformation on an ongoing daily basis. And you have to take people with you on that journey.
And as you've said, I mean, these are really quite significant people management challenges which
yes.
need to be addressed.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just trying to summarise what it is principally that is preventing an effective response to all of this. We've talked about a lack of understanding. Well, there's a little bit of that still, I sense you feel. A lack of resolve. Everybody surely is agreed that this is something that we need to get to grips with. Or is there still a lack of resolve in some areas, do you think?
I think that a lot of the resolve starts at the top of the company. You have to create the right environment. So if your resolve at the highest of levels is to grow your market share to the exclusion of everything else, Some might say that's rather irresponsible. Others would say, well, it's understandable, depending on the environment. You may decide that an investment in security is one that you could probably go without over a period of time. So the challenge is in this alignment. It's about saying that security is not a cost. It's actually an enabler. It's back to this old chestnut of mine, my favorite, you know, security by design. Build security in at the beginning. It will cost you less. It will give you a strategic advantage. There is no doubt about that now. Security has moved from being this sort of optional extra to actually being a competitive advantage. If you can demonstrate that you are collecting data, storing data, using data responsibly, ethically, securely, that will create a competitive advantage for you in the market. And so it's about alignment of corporate strategy with all of those things. And I think that some businesses have actually understood that, and they're beginning to implement on that basis.
And if you do understand that, you then develop the resolve to do all the things you've been talking about. But is there still a lack of skills and resources, which is a significant problem, do you think?
It is. I mean, there is a skill shortage. There's no doubt about that. But I think that there are ways of getting around that. I think that we have to be very much more open to bringing people in who can learn on the job, who have skills that are hugely important to the sorts of things you and I have just been talking about, soft skills. If you need a cybersecurity leader, then don't just look within the security field, because a lot of the job requires soft skills that the traditional, perhaps, technology person may not have. So maybe those skills live with somebody who's in marketing or in human resources or in sales or in other parts of the business. And I think there's that realization that it is easier to provide some of the technical support, whether that be through experts in the business or through third parties, than to provide some of the inherent soft skills that are fundamental to success in this space.
And you deal with a lot of major companies. Is this what you see the best, the companies which exercise best practice, is this what they are doing?
They're certainly focusing very much more on emotional intelligence, soft skills, security awareness, but also making sure that they've got the level of support that they need from a technical standpoint. And they're not afraid to take what they're doing in one part of the business and use it in another. What do I mean by that? Artificial intelligence, machine learning. That's something that I personally believe will have a significant impact on cybersecurity going forward, the ability to anticipate where an attacker might be coming from and therefore to prevent them gaining access and stealing our information. Very many organizations are working on artificial intelligence solutions, but not in security. And so instead of creating this wall, we'll collaborate. So take something that the marketing guys are working on, say from an AI perspective, and see whether or not it can be used, whether you can learn. That's what the smart organizations are doing. They've broken down those walls and they're collaborating across the enterprise.
It's an enormously daunting challenge because the boundaries are just changing almost on a daily basis, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean,
so what is the role of the ISF in assisting companies to deal with this, to feel less daunted by all of this?
Yeah, I mean, the ISF for me has a very privileged position, in that we are a not-for-profit, we are independent, we do work very collaboratively with some of the largest companies in the world. And we have that global perspective across all vertical sectors. And there is, I think, a continuation of the founding principles around the ISF, which is about sharing, which is about collaborating, making sure that the community is best placed. And we see that in the research that we produce. So Threat Horizon being just one of the things that we do that tries to look forward to enable our members to deal with the future. We see it in some of the elements around regulation. We've got a very significant piece of work that we're finishing off at the moment around the regulatory environment around the world, so that people can understand from a multinational standpoint what they need to be doing in the different geographies in which they are based. So we have a research role. We also have a very practical role to help people implement. So our tools do that. I've talked about cyber risk. Well, we have risk assessment tools that enable you to risk assess on a qualitative basis, but more importantly, also to quantify that risk so that you're able to answer some of those questions that the board might have. And then we provide, of course, the collaborative environment too. And we shouldn't underestimate the power of that, members talking to members. The ISF's job is to continue doing all of those and to create and foster an environment where people seem comfortable with what we're producing, ready to share, and ready and willing to contribute.
One priority for the next 12 months, what would it be?
From an ISF standpoint or from a...
Well, from a general cybersecurity stroke ISF, because I'm quite, you know, the two things are sort of interdependent, aren't they?
Yeah, they are to a certain extent, I think, because we're obviously, you know, embedded in that industry. I think the one priority that I would pull out for people is really around collaboration. It is about how do we do a better job, whether we be in government, whether we be a regulator, whether we be an organization, whether we be an individual. In really pulling together this collective knowledge that we have to combat the challenges that we face from a cyber perspective and which are developing and changing on a minute-by-minute basis.
Steve Durbin, good luck. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. Thanks.
Thanks for tuning into our video cast with journalist Nick Witchell and ISF Managing Director Steve Durbin. If you found this conversation of value, please share it in your networks. And we invite you to visit securityforum.org to join the conversation on our LinkedIn group, to access our robust podcast and videocast library, and to download ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance. Thanks for watching.